I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is character actor, author, and podcaster Stephen Tobolowsky. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Stephen Tobolowsky. I know you all recognize him from his wonderful roles in countless movies and TV shows, and also know him probably from his wonderful Tobolowsky Files podcast and his terrific books, The Dangerous Animals Club, and his new book, My Adventures with God. This book is a series of short stories exploring the idea that most people's lives seem to fit into the template of the Old Testament, and it is a funny, introspective collection about love, catastrophe, and triumph, and provides a structure for us to evaluate our own lives and relationship to God. So please join me to welcome Stephen Tobolowsky to the JCC.
Thank you very much, Jordan. I heard all those whoops. How many people here listen to the podcast? Oh, okay. So that's very good. So we love that. Part of this may be a duplicate for you already know this, but a little bit about how this book came to be is it comes from the terrible accident that many of you know I encountered in 2008. For those of you who don't know, I broke my neck in five places, riding a horse on the side of an active volcano in Iceland. How could anything possibly have gone wrong? The doctor told me that I had a fatal injury. That's what he told me. I'm alive. He's telling me it's fatal. Terrible misuse of the word fatal, if nothing else. So recovering, I'm in one of these braces. I wasn't wearing a halo. But I got this notion, what happened if what the doctor said was true? Just as therapy for my head. What happened if I really did die on that mountain? What would I want my boys, my two boys, Robert and William, to know about their dad? And so what I started to do was I started to write these true stories from my life that I wanted my two kids to know about their father. And these stories became the Tobolowsky Files, and they ended up getting recorded, some of them on NPR stations and on PRI stations around the country. And it became the first book, Dangerous Animals Club. And after the Dangerous Animals Club came out, my editor, Ben, at Simon & Schuster said, well, people really are responding to the humor in your stories, but one thing that they really respond to is the spiritual elements in your story. Could you write another book of true stories and have it connected with some sort of spiritual through line? And that is... Well, of course, I said yes, first of all. You know, I had no idea what I was going to write. But I said yes, and then I thought of the conceit that Jordan mentioned. That, and at first it was just a conceit to put the book together. But then the more I thought about it, the truer it was that all of our lives, at least everybody I know, fall into the template of the Old Testament in that all of us seem to have these Genesis stories that usually are the first stories we tell on a first date with the first glass of Chardonnay about who we are and where we came from and what our parents are and what our aspirations are. And then all of us seem to go into slavery at one point in time. But instead of building pyramids, it's slavery through first love, first loss, terrible first employment, some poor souls through drugs and alcohol, and other people just staying in graduate school forever. Then, like in the Bible, we get out of slavery only to find that we're still stuck in the middle of the desert. And then we have this Leviticus moment. And the Leviticus moment is where we say, hold it, this is what I am. You know, Leviticus is a very interesting book in the Bible, in the Torah. It's very interesting because they say that historically, however much you want to apply history to the Torah, that Genesis takes something like 2,400 years, and various biblical scholars have different opinions as to what Leviticus is, varying from 1 week to 1 day. And Leviticus is also the smallest book in the Torah and most potent. So we have this moment in the middle of our life where we say, wait, this is what I am. This is when I married that young lady back there, Anne. This is when I got married. This is when I became a father. This is when I returned to Judaism in a very serious way. And then we're shaped by mortality, as in the book of Numbers, as we lose those that we've loved, family, friends. And then if we're lucky, we get to Deuteronomy, where we end up telling our stories to others, trying to make sense of what this entire journey was about anyway. That became the template of my adventures with God. And for those who know the podcast, I'll reiterate my slogan is that I believe in telling true stories. The stories I'm going to tell tonight are as true as I can make them, because I believe true always trumps clever. That no matter how different this story is from your life, you will hear the true in here, and you'll have some sort of reflection in it, maybe, to something that happened to you. And also, when you tell a true story, there's the possibility of the story continuing. My adventures with God took about 3 years to write. And while I was writing my adventures with God, some of the stories had secondary parts happen because they were true. And they ended up in later parts of the book as callbacks, which were very surprising to me. This story that I'm going to read now is called The Things We Saved from the Fire. And it's a story in the Deuteronomy section of the book. The synagogue asked if I could step in as usher on a Saturday morning service. This meant shaking hands, passing out prayer books. I said yes. Feels good to help out. Get to dress up in your nice clothes. And it becomes an act of courage if you do it without Purell. I was talking to the woman who was greeting with me, and she told me a story from her childhood, and it was a story I've not been able to shake. When she was little, her family lived in the North Hills of the San Fernando Valley. They have a microclimate there. Instead of summer, spring, winter, fall, they have fire season and flood season. The fire department used to make regular visits, ordering them to evacuate. One day, when she was little, she heard a knock at the door. A fireman was there in full gear, standing there telling her father they had to be out of the area within an hour. She was terrified. They had a family meeting as to what they would save from the fire. 4 people, 1 car. They began the mathematical calculation of loss and salvation. As fire season turned to flood season and back to fire season again, the process became simpler and simpler. With each evacuation, she took less and less. In the end, she said, she only took 1 change of clothes and the sewing machine she bought with her bat mitzvah money when she was 13. I asked her why the sewing machine. She said, because it was the only thing that I knew that was really mine. The only time I ever heard the knock at the door, it wasn't the fire marshal, it was the cardiologist. I had visited my dad in Dallas. I felt an odd pressure on my chest. It was like the angel touching me, my breastbone, with her finger saying, I think you're next. I went to my doctor back in L.A. I needed tests. Someone concluded that men don't like to go to doctors as much as women. I don't know who did this study, but it is true. I hate getting medical tests. First, you have to endure the inflated prices of parking at medical buildings. Then you have to sit with sick people in a waiting room for an hour. Then a nurse brings you back to another waiting room where she asks you to take off your clothes. You sit on butcher paper and read a magazine you would never read in your life, like Auto World. Then the doctor arrives and the tests commence. And either they will find nothing and you have wasted time and money for no good reason, or they find something, and it's the end of life as you know it. In my case, they found something. I needed more tests. 2 weeks later, I was on a treadmill. 2 weeks after that, I was on an operating table getting an angiogram. The doctor said I would be mildly sedated. Hospitals have a different definition of mildly. I was seeing sounds. I was hearing colors. The nurses transformed into the witches of Macbeth. They were dancing around the room. At some point, the cardiologist leaned over and smiled at me. His face looked like a close-up from a Sergio Leone Western. He said, "You're Stephen Tobolowsky, aren't you?" "Yes," I muttered. "You're the guy who tells stories." "Yeah," I said. He leaned in closer and said, "Were you going to write a story about me?" And I said, "Well, it depends, doesn't it?" He laughed and started walking around the operating table. I called out, "Doc, can we just wrap this up? I want to get out of here." He says, "Oh, we're done. We finished a long time ago. We're just cleaning up now." I said, "So what's the verdict? Do I need a stent? Can I go home?" He says, "Oh, no, no, no. You need immediate surgery. Triple bypass. Your wife and doctor are here. They're waiting for you in the recovery room." They rolled me into a dark room where Ann and Jeff, my doctor, were waiting. Ann was crying. Jeff was trying to smile. That's a bad combination. Jeff brought in a heart surgeon. The surgeon said I could go into pre-op now and have the surgery in the next 36 hours or wait 2 weeks. He had jury duty. We picked option one. The surgeon leaned in and spoke quietly. He was not friendly, but there was something comforting in his no-nonsense bedside manner. He said, "We're going to do a lot of tests now. Tomorrow, finish any unfinished business. Say goodbye to whoever you need to say goodbye to. Dot your I's, cross your T's. I'll see you at dawn the following morning." I got home that night and looked in the bathroom mirror. My arms and legs were covered with magic marker indicating where they were going to harvest arteries for the operation. I stepped into the shower. I turned the water on as high as California regulations would allow. I slid down the tile wall onto the floor with the water beating on my head, and I held myself and I cried. I said goodbye to my body. I realized this would be the last day I would see myself whole, or worse, it could be the last day I see myself at all. I couldn't sleep. Neither could Anne. The next morning, I was up, turned on the computer, time to finish unfinished business. There was my book, Dangerous Animals Club. Forget it. There's a story here, story there. Forget it. Unfinished story. Forget it. Some notes. Forget it. Forget it. Forget it. Forget it. It took me a whole lifetime to realize I had no unfinished business. I never did. I called up my dad. I told him I loved him. I called up my brother, Paul. Paul's a doctor. He told me it would all go fine. My hospital had one of the highest success rates for this surgery in the country. He had looked it up. He told me I had been a great brother. He was happy to know me. I called my sister Barbara, the same. That night at the dinner table, I told my children, Robert and William, that I had to go in for surgery in the morning. It was serious. I told them I loved them. And whatever happened, never forget that I loved them more than anything. The boys were silent for a moment, and then William said, "Dad, don't be such a drama queen." The hospital call that night, they reminded me when I came in the morning, I was to come with nothing, nothing. No wallet, no glasses, no wedding ring, nothing. The knock was at my door. It was time to leave. I had to choose what I would save from the fire. Anne said she would bring a little suitcase with some clothes, anything I wanted. I asked her to bring my prayer book. It was the only thing I knew that was really mine. 2 years later, We're sitting around the dining table. William was home from college. Yeah, William coming home is more like a transcontinental jet docking for fuel, except in William's case, he's docking for clean underwear. In between texting his friends, catching up on homework, and watching old episodes of Locked Up Abroad, he said rather mysteriously, "I need to talk to you, Dad." There was an urgency in this matter, so I said, "Sure, not here." I said, "Okay." So we adjourned to neutral ground over by the cat food bowls over in the kitchen. William said, "I need to tell you something." I said, "Shoot." "I didn't mean that thing I said when I called you a drama queen when you were going into surgery. That wasn't nice. I think I was just scared. I apologize for not visiting you in the hospital." I was so relieved. I thought he was about to tell me he wanted to date Steven Spielberg's daughter. I told him sincerely I was fine with him not visiting me at the hospital. It was awful. Between the blood on my gown and the pee bottle by my bedside, it was not my finest hour. William shook his head as if I had not heard him. "Dad, I'm sorry. Robert visited you. I should have visited you too." I hugged him. I said, "You just did." I walked over, poured myself a glass of wine. "I appreciate the thought, though. I knew you cared. I knew you loved me." We returned to the table. The boys went back to discussing which countries were most abusive when they catch American tourists with small amounts of pot. My mind went back to that awful day before I left for the hospital. Hindsight is 20/20. A phrase coined in the age of ophthalmology. It's not true. Hindsight does not enable you to see more details from the past. It makes the logic of the past appear more random. So you recall details you never saw before, but you forget the obvious. New patterns emerge. In this case, I was struck by the prayer book decision. Now, not my choice to bring one, but which one to bring? I had amassed a few over the years, and I only wanted to take one. I think taking more than one prayer book to a hospital appeared to be an act of pessimism. I needed to stay positive. The heart surgery handout instructed me not to eat or drink several hours before arriving, which meant no martinis. I had to remain upbeat, unassisted. What was odd was my choice of the daily prayer book by Joseph Hertz. Most traditional Jews know this book affectionately as The Hertz. Larry Miller, great actor and writer, he introduced me to it. It's huge, it's heavy, it's annotated. It's used more for reference, not for contemplation. In hindsight, the only reason I could see for picking The Hertz was I must have subconsciously been saying to myself, it is time for me to start a new project. I just don't know what the new project's going to be. When I was being prepped for surgery, the nurse asked me if I wanted to speak to a rabbi. I never had good sales resistance, but in this case, it seemed like an affectation to say no. The nurse couldn't guarantee someone would actually show up. She said, "Priests and rabbis are very busy in this wing of the hospital." Duh! Yeah. There's nothing like a bit of the obvious to serve as sorbet before surgery. I said, "I understand." She said, "Well, I'll put you on the list." The last one-on-one conversations I had with a rabbi was with my old Rabbi Schimmel over a pot of hot dog stew and with Rabbi Klein at my mother's funeral. I didn't know what to really expect from a professional rabbi. I had time to prepare myself. My name didn't come up on the rabbi's list for 4 days. That does not adequately describe the time period. When you're in the hospital, you start counting time in something akin to dog years. 4 days equals 2.5 lifetimes, or flying around the world on Alitalia watching Crocodile Hunter dubbed in Italian. It challenges notions of eternity.
You're listening to character actor, author, and podcaster Stephen Tobolowsky, whose new book is My Adventures with God, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
By the time the rabbi knocked at my door, I had forgotten he was coming. A pleasant-looking middle-aged man with a trim beard stuck his head in the room. He smiled and waved at the door. "You sent for me?" At first, I thought he was the orderly with the foot massagers. Then I saw the shirt-tie, no-jacket combination. I thought, oh, he's from the insurance company. Then he wandered in, saw the yarmulke. "Got it." I said, "You're the rabbi." He said, "Yes. You wanted to speak with me. Is this a good time?" I said, "Any time in here is a good time. Please, come in." I turned off the television. The rabbi grabbed the chair that all hospital rooms provide for the visitor. I gestured, please, make yourself comfortable. The rabbi pulled the chair a suitable distance away from me in case I happened to be contagious, and he sat down. He's a very handsome older man, a little gray in his hair. He carried a prayer book, not the Hertz. He smiled. I smiled back. And I realized I had nothing to say. So I made something up. I said, "I imagine you see a lot of people who are in bad shape like me." The rabbi laughed and said, "Well, I don't know how bad a shape you're in. I see a lot of very sick people, people who've had major surgeries. They told me you just had a triple bypass." I go, "Yeah, yes, triple, double, quadruple. Who's counting?" He says, "Well, how are you feeling?" I said, "Physically, I think I'm where I should be." The rabbi said, "Well, they tell me it's a lot like being hit by a bus." I said, "No, it's more like being hit by a streetcar, but one of those big old horse-drawn streetcars. I'm happy I feel as good as I do. Thanks to the pharmacy downstairs, I don't have any pain, as long as I don't move too quickly for the TV changer. Mentally, though, I don't feel that I'm quite right." The rabbi got concerned and said, "Well, it's quite common for this operation to lead to depression. Make sure you talk to someone if you feel overwhelmed or suicidal." I said, "Overwhelmed, yes. Suicidal, no. Actually, now that you bring that up, I'm feeling quite hopeful. I'm just not sure what I'm supposed to learn from all of this." The rabbi furrowed his brow and said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, experience taught me there's always been a lesson in catastrophes I've gone through. I had a broken neck 2 years ago, and I learned a lot from it. But I can't figure this one out. I have no idea what I was supposed to understand, except maybe I ate too many French fries." "Well, maybe that's all there is," the rabbi said. "Maybe there doesn't have to be a lesson. It's enough that you're alive." At that moment, I thought of some of the people on my floor that didn't make it through that particular night. And I was unexpectedly hit with a wave of loss. And I tried to gather my thoughts and continue, "Rabbi, I would hate to think that's true. Let me ask you something." "Yes." "You see a lot of people like me." "Yes," he answered. "How would you describe them?" The rabbi thought for a little bit. "They are afraid." "Yes, generally I would say the people I meet are filled with fear." Now that's interesting, I said, "because I haven't been. Not really. Days before the surgery, I was scared. And then the night before, I was calm. I realized it was none of my business." The rabbi asked, "What wasn't?" I said, "Whether I lived or died. It was more the surgeon's business. Of course, I was concerned. I was concerned for my wife and my children, but I was not afraid of anything. It was out of my control." When you talk to people who are afraid, what do you say? The rabbi leaned in and said, "I usually read one of the Psalms." "Which one?" The rabbi patted his prayer book. "The 23rd Psalm is usually what people get comfort from." I said, "The Lord is my shepherd?" "Yes," the rabbi said. "It's one of the shortest psalms, but certainly one of the most powerful." I said, "I would think that walking through the valley of shadow of death part would not be too comforting in a hospital. The rabbi looked at me and shook his head and said, "You would be surprised." "Rabbi, what comforts you when you're afraid?" He looked at me with a sort of amused bewilderment. What do you mean? I said, "When you wake up in the middle of the night, when you feel lost, do you read the 23rd Psalm?" He smiled and said, "You know, no one has ever asked me that question before. I'll have to think about that. But what gives you comfort in here, now? What keeps you from being afraid?" I was stumped. I opened my mouth to speak, unsure of what came out, and I said, "No horizon. That's what gives me comfort." "I don't understand," the rabbi said. I laughed and said, "Neither do I. Let me try to explain. My whole life, I've looked for the point on the horizon, the point in the distance I was headed toward. If there was a disaster, if someone tried to get in my way, I would just keep fixed on that point and say to myself, I am still on course. I know where I'm going. Not anymore. I let that go." The rabbi looked concerned. I tried to assure him, "No, Rabbi, no. This is a good thing. I have no horizon. I want no horizon. I have no expectations because time..." And I stopped. The tiny pieces of an intricate puzzle started to fall together, and the rabbi must have thought I was having a small stroke because he leaned forward and said, "Are you all right?" I said, yes, I'm all right, I'm fine. I was just saying, I have no horizon. I want no horizon because time doesn't matter to me anymore. I tried to get a hold of my ideas before they ran away. "Rabbi, something happened to me in the ICU, something I can't explain." Time stopped. The rabbi leaned forward trying to understand. I said, "It was like science fiction. When I woke up from surgery, there was a digital clock on the wall. It said 2 p.m. I heard voices. Doctors and nurses came and went. I fell asleep. I had a dream. I woke up. It was still 2 p.m. I felt tubes running down my throat. I began to choke. The alarm went off by my bed. I couldn't move. The doctor came in and whispered that they would take the tubes out as soon as I woke up a little more. It shouldn't be more than 20 minutes, but the clock never changed. It was 2 p.m., 2 p.m., always. I felt like I was drowning. I couldn't breathe. I panicked, and I found a little place inside myself where I could survive. And I stayed there. Then minutes began to change, slowly. They finally took the tubes out at 6 p.m., but for those 4 hours, I was disconnected from time. I have never experienced anything like it. Now, this is different than going to play poker and suddenly it's dawn. It's the opposite, Rabbi. Imagine you go to play poker, you play all night, you look at your watch, and it's the same time as when you got there. The rabbi said, "I think that would be strange." Yes, sir. It was very, very strange. I couldn't have gotten through those 4 hours looking for a horizon. It was useless. I couldn't look out. I had to look in. The rabbi sat back and said, "Well, that makes sense. But now that you aren't in such crisis, how do you feel about time now?" I thought about it for a moment and I said, "Well, I think I've been changed. You know, Rabbi, maybe this is what I was supposed to learn from all of this. I saw that the past is gone. Doesn't exist anymore except as I remember it. The people, the places, my mother, the pooch, my dear friend Bob, all gone. And the future, promised to no one. If you don't believe that, just take one little walk around the cardio ward." And the rabbi said, "So all we're left with is the present. The only thing that exists is the now." And I shook my head, "No, Rabbi. We don't even have the now. The now vanishes before we even know it." And he laughed and he said, "Well, what's left?" I looked at the rabbi and understood, "Rabbi, the only thing we ever have left is the next moment. You could do whatever you want in the next moment. You could get drunk. You could watch TV, read a book, rob a bank. But there are only two things you could do that matter. You could tell someone that you love them, or you could try to undo a regret from the past. That's it. In the end, that's all that's going to matter. We sat in silence for a bit, and then the rabbi said, "Well, I'll think on that. This moment's already gone by too fast. I need to be going, but it was a pleasure meeting you. Rest peacefully. I hope you're able to go home soon." "So do I. And thank you for dropping by, Rabbi. And I'm going to read the 23rd Psalm. Thank you." When the rabbi left, I grabbed the Hertz. I found the 23rd Psalm and I tried to read it out loud. I couldn't. It meant too much to me. "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green meadows. Beside tranquil waters he leads me. He restores my soul." Wait. That's a line I never heard before. He restores my soul. God is there to heal your soul, not your body. For that you need doctors, you need hospitals, you need to exercise and take care of yourself. It's a partnership. If that partnership is successful, you will be able to fear no evil, even though you walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Sounds like a deal to me. That evening, I was watching college football. Anne came with some slippers, a bathrobe, and an unexpected visitor, my eldest son, Robert. Robert pulled the visitor's chair and sat down. His face broke out in a huge grin. He donned his well-practiced sarcasm. "So, you living it up in here?" "How could I not? They're having trouble keeping me down." "Yeah, I see. TV changer. Party Central." "So how have you been?" I said. "What, you mean since you saw me 4 days ago?" "Sure, that'll do." Robert stretched and said, "Well, Papa, I've been doing better than you. You feeling all right?" "Not bad. The worst thing is, my tears burn." "What do you mean?" "Yeah, it's strange. I'm not being poetic here. It feels like twice a day someone has switched my Visine with contact lens cleaning solution. It burns. It's hard for me to see." "Yeah. Sounds nasty, Dad. What medicines are you taking?" "Everything." "Yeah, well, that's probably it. How's the scar?" I said, "Well, that's a surprise. It's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Can I see it?" Robert inched forward. "Sure." And I pulled my gown down in front. Robert peeked and made a face. "Impressive." "Yeah, I know," I said. "People used to get tattooed before they went into battle. Today, I think people get tattooed to pretend they had a battle to go to. This will be my tattoo." Robert raised his eyebrows. "Careful. You're getting trendy, Dad. Well, I'll leave you and Mom to enjoy the evening. Frankly, this place gives me the willies. When do you think you'll be home?" "Hopefully in another 3 or 4 days," I said. He came over and gently hugged me. He said, "Be well. And don't worry about your tears. Just remember right now a big part of your reality is pharmacological." And he was gone. Hindsight is 20/20. 2 years after the surgery, and we were together, sitting around our dining room table, the weight of past events had been redistributed. Moments of life and death receded. Anne's courage and Robert's smile have moved to the fore. I sipped my wine and looked around the table. Robert and William were in an animated conversation as to what they would do if they were locked up abroad. Anne was carefully eating a green bean. I was sitting with no horizon, completely happy, knowing that whatever the next moment was, I'd be doing it with the people who mattered the most to me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is a slice of a story, a smaller story, called The Speed. The larger story is The Speed of Everything. And it's, again, that son of a bitch, son of mine, Robert, is giving me hell. He's the scientist, and he's always giving me grief. But this is a diversion in the story about when I was 19. I was 19 in this. It was a very good year. I had a car, I had a girl, and a credit card my parents paid for. But my biggest achievement was I had figured out the meaning of life. Sort of. It was more that I settled on my first dilemma. And a dilemma that you stick with is as close a thing to a spiritual belief as you can get. This is what I decided on. Either everything in life has a meaning, we just don't know what it is, or nothing has meaning, but it doesn't matter. And I went back and forth in the various camps throughout my life. I was in the meaning is everywhere camp in college. To that end, I studied everything I could. 17th century Spanish theater, the Bhagavad Gita, werewolves. It didn't matter how obscure a subject was. I felt any little fact could be the key to open the door to wisdom. Then one night, I went too far. I spent 3 days trying to memorize the Bowen cycle of igneous rocks while reading a biography of Bruce Lee. Something inside of me broke. I saw with blinding clarity that there was no way I could know everything. In fact, if I studied like this my whole life, I would still know practically nothing. It was depressing. But then I began to see it as a revelation. Maybe knowing things is not that important. Maybe life is bigger than anything I could imagine. And I found this exhilarating, and I jumped over to the meaning doesn't matter camp. Oh, it is the lazy man's belief system. It has one commandment, and that is there will always be a gap between what we think we know and what is really going on. And everything is a product of unintended consequences. And one of my favorite stories that brought me around to this way of thinking was something I read on a flight to England in 1974, concerned a problem with the London Zoo. The gorillas weren't mating. Zookeepers called in gorilla experts. They ruled out depression. The animals weren't in cages. They had space. Not enough to feel like they were at home, but at least enough for them to feel like they were at an extended stay Marriott. The experts concluded that since the gorillas learn about mating from observation in the wild, perhaps these gorillas were too young at the time of their capture to understand life's little moments that make being a gorilla worthwhile. So at great expense to the British taxpayer, the London Zoo sent a camera crew to Africa to film gorillas mating, sort of gorilla porn films. The plan was to edit the mating footage into an endless loop and project it at night in the gorilla enclosure, hoping the silverbacks would watch and get the idea. At the end of 6 months, none of the female gorillas were pregnant, but all of the zookeepers' wives were. I am positive that probably nothing in this story was true, except the bit, of course, about the British government making gorilla porn. I still loved it for a lot of reasons, like stories about filmmaking. I am partial to gorillas. But at the heart of it, I loved it because I knew on a deeper level it was true. It is an accurate depiction of a universe of unintended consequences. In his book of essays, The Dyer's Hand, poet W.H. Auden wrote a brilliant piece on comedy. If anyone is an actor, you should read The Dyer's Hand. Auden is brilliant. He says the comedy arises from the tension created by the vast distance between our intentions and their results. And he uses the example of the man slipping on the banana peel. He points out that what amuses us is not the fall, but that the banana peel was in plain sight. Comedy reveals truth. And the truth with gorillas and banana peels is the same. Man's inherent problem is one of vision. But vision is never a matter of simply looking. It's a matter of knowing what you see.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features character actor, author, and podcaster Stephen Tobolowsky, whose new book is My Adventures with God. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
This brings me story number two, and this one I know is true because I was there. 14 years later, I was on a plane flight to England with my girlfriend, Anne, before she became my wife, Anne. On the flight over, Anne asked me if I wanted to do anything in particular on our trip to London. I said, "Why, I was always up for going to a play. Maybe we could go to the Tate Gallery. Also, if there's time, I wouldn't mind going to the London Zoo." Anne was surprised. She said, "The zoo?" I go, "Yes. I read an article a few years back about the gorillas and thought maybe we could see the exhibit. I thought it might be interesting." Anne and I were at that blissful early stage in a relationship when you're happy doing anything your partner wants, even going to the zoo. So she said it all sounded good. She was happy just being with me. Now, we had only planned on being in London for 3 days before we rented a car to see some of the prehistoric sites of England. Anne was a fan of Les Morts d'Arthur, which is all you really need to know about a girl. She was hot to see the ruins of Camelot. Unfortunately, we had considerable less time in London than we had planned. We spent almost all 3 days in bed. Yes, yeah, no. At this point, I would like to wink and say we were impetuous, but we weren't. We were unconscious. We had a near-terminal case of jet lag, and we fell asleep with the television on. We slept for 3 days with the cricket test match of England versus Cameroon playing day and night. It was the backdrop of all my dreams. I'm sure the people in the next room thought we were the biggest cricket fans in the world. Our inability to wake up seriously ate into our theater outings. So we saw nothing. Never made it to the Tate, never made it to the British Museum. However, we woke up on dawn of day three, and I said, "Baby, I bet we still have time to go to the zoo." Anne was a good sport. We took the tube, we got off at the appropriate spot, jumped out, headed for the ticket booth. It was like a post-apocalyptic movie. The gates of the zoo were wide open. No one was there. No one was in the ticket booth. We were pressed for time. We had to get our rental car. I told Anne, "Let's just go in, see the gorillas, and pay on our way out." We walked in. I don't know how many of you have been to the London Zoo. It was very disappointing. It's huge. We wandered down a deserted pathway with rows and rows of cages, and just about every animal on display appeared to be some kind of rat. Desert rat, Siberian rat, Canadian gerbil, Asian stoat. Nothing interesting. Off in the distance, I saw a dog running in circles, chasing its tail in the sunlight. I said, "Anne, this is pathetic. House of 1,000 rats and one dog." Then in the distance, I see a man wearing a solid khaki outfit and a pith helmet, and my brain says, "Oh, probable zoo personnel." He saw me and started waving his arms. I waved back. I figured I could ask him where the gorillas were. Maybe this visit would be worthwhile after all. At that point, the dog took off toward the heart of the zoo. The man in the khaki outfit took off after the dog. I said to Anne, "Wonder what that was all about." Anne, always one to look at the bright side, said, "Maybe the dog was rabid. You never know." Anne and I continued looking at rats and voles and moles, vole, mole, vole, mole, hoping to find something that pointed to something more memorable. Then Anne grabbed my arm. "Stephen!" I stopped and looked up. 20 yards away from us, crouching under some bushes, was the dog. It watched us silently. Anne and I started backing up, The dog lowered its head and leapt out of the bushes and ran right at us, didn't bark or growl. And there's something about his charge that wasn't threatening. It seemed more of a celebration. He stopped midway, jumped up, made a spin in the air, landed, and continued racing toward us. At this, a man jumped out and shouted, "Don't move!" It was the man in khaki. He came out of nowhere. "Stand still!" Ann and I froze. The dog began to circle us. He stopped 3 feet away, opened his mouth to yawn and stretch, and that's when we saw the dog was not a dog. It was a baby rhinoceros. He took off running again. The zookeeper took off after the little fellow and called back, "It's a white rhino, just a few weeks old, one of the rarest in the world. You don't see these in captivity." The baby rhino was distracted by sunlight. He thought it was alive. He turned and was impressed by his shadow. Ann and I didn't move. We couldn't move. We were in awe. It was probably one of the most remarkable, one of the most beautiful things we had ever seen. The zookeeper slowly walked up and fed him a treat and put a collar on him and breathed a sigh of relief. "Don't want anything to happen to this little boy. Have a good morning." Man and beast headed back down the road to the animal nursery. And we almost missed it all. It was a question of vision. We had a very low expectation of the miraculous. Fortunately for Anne and me, this unintended consequence had legs. After that morning in London, I found myself back in the meaning is everywhere camp. Faith and science are not that dissimilar. Both are dependent upon what you are inclined to see. I know this is true. I learned it from a rhinoceros. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We have time for questions.
First question's right here.
Oh, thank you. Stephen, I'm not surprised that your editor wanted you to write a book that had a through line of spirituality, because I think when you are at your most brilliant, it's when you're talking about our evolving relationship to the way we organize the world around us. And it's something that I've been getting out of your work more recently. It could be my perspective, but there seems to be a growing celebration of subjectivity, or your relationship to subjectivity has changed, maybe even since you lost your horizon. And I'm going to offer three little bits of evidence. Tonight you said, in hindsight, the logic of the past starts to appear more random.
Right.
In a recent podcast episode, you talked about the version of our past, I'm paraphrasing, but the version of our past that we embraced is the one that we need to survive.
Yes.
And then my favorite, you said in another episode, the only bridge between doubt and certainty is imagination. Do you see a breadcrumb trail between those?
Yeah, I see. Referencing podcasts, you know, it's a big deal realizing that what we know in our heads is always a finite set. And we end up choosing what's in that finite set. And like Isaac Newton said, the universe abhors a vacuum and something will fill in to rush nothing. You know, something will fill in to fill up nothing. And so a lot of what we fill up in are the things we need to survive, but also they're the things we choose to let in. And that's where I think things become more random. That, for example, that's one reason why I think Judaism stuck with me and was very powerful to me, because you have centuries of wisdom kind of layered. And it's one reason that Judaism has these centuries of wisdom layered, I think, at least some of the things I've read, is because of the commandment, you won't have any graven images. So you don't have any great Jewish art except till you get to like Chagall. I mean, you don't have all these great, great edifices like the early Christian art. So their art became philosophy. And it's in the Talmud and the Midrash and the Zohar. And their you have to view their observations as random filters on what they saw as being true. That may be getting into the weeds, but I think the answer to your question is yes. As I've grown in my life, I'm more conscious of the things I allow into the vacuum of my brain. And I'll stay away from the horses. That too. Yeah. I hope I answered that.
When you're writing, how do you selectively balance between humor and pathos?
I don't select. What I do is I try to, if there is a subject that compels me to write, I just write. And I don't think about it, and I see how it develops. And I don't worry about starting at the beginning of a story. I can maybe start at the end and work backwards, or the middle and work both ways. I don't think about it, because a lot of times, 50% of the time, as I'm writing a story, I realize after I've written quite a bit, oh my goodness, this isn't the story I thought I was telling. And the story changes. So I want to allow that to happen. Now, as to where the humor and pathos happens, it's just difficult for me to write without telling jokes. It's just what I've always done. So I do that. And when I send it to Simon and Schuster, you know, that editor guy, you know, he'll like cross out jokes. And I'm going like, Ben, you know, I write back, are you kidding? These are jokes, man. He goes, Stephen, too many jokes, Stephen. Let's just do one joke at a time, my friend. You know, so I think it's true too in terms of actors. You can't really act or write if you're your own critic while you're doing it. It's important to just write, because even if you write something that's terrible, it often opens a door to something that's really good, and then you go back later and you change it. That's the beauty of it. And with acting, just do it, because sometimes you need to do that to get to this point. And don't self-criticize while you're in the process of writing. Just save that for later.
When you write true stories, what you write about you is your choice, but for your family and friends, it might not be. Does that lead to funny or delicate moments of negotiation, or do they just take it as the price of being your wife, your child, your friend?
Sort of, but no. For example, I write a lot of stories about my ex-girlfriend, Beth, and I sent her all the stories to read, and she sent me back, and we hadn't talked in like 20 years. So in a way, the stories gave us a chance to talk again, and she said she started to read the story in Dangerous Animals Club about the death of my mother, and she said she couldn't read it, and she just had to lay in bed and for a day, and she said, is there anything that you wrote that's going to make my head explode? And I said, never. I would never do that. And so I don't ambush people. If I write stories about people, I send them the stories ahead of time to say, like, are you, because I'll change your name if you don't want your name. My wife Ann says that I have permission to write anything about her that I want, and I will. But I, for example, my sister doesn't want me to write stories about her, so I will not. My brother, I always send him stuff I write about. And I try to use it to honor the people I've known as opposed to gossip. I don't believe in gossip.
Could you tell us about apparently your experience when you were in a supermarket and it was robbed?
I was held hostage at gunpoint in a grocery store. Yes, and it's in the first book. The story is called Light of the First Day, and I was held hostage at gunpoint in a grocery store when I was 25, I believe is how old I was, and I didn't notice the mass exodus happen when the crazy guy with the gun walked in, because I was busy buying mangoes. Because it was like a new fruit in Texas at the time. You know, I go like, well, Beth will enjoy a mango. And so I'm like shaking the mangoes and not paying attention. And this guy comes up to me and puts his hand on my grocery cart, which is wrong. I mean, a man's grocery cart is sacrosanct. I mean, it's like touching someone's belt buckle, you know. You only do it by invitation. And he says, I see you have mangoes, the most exotic of fruits. And I'm thinking, this guy is crazy or whatever. And I reach into the grocery cart thinking, well, I'll give the guy a mango and maybe he'll go away. And I reach down, and from my new perspective, I saw that he had a .45 caliber handgun behind his back on his hip. And at that moment, I knew I was dead. Knew it. And he saw the look in my eye, and he saw that my heart and soul and mind were gone. So he knew I knew. And he starts crying and says, like, I don't know why I picked you today. I don't know why. And he puts the gun into my forehead, and I'm looking, and I'm the only one in the store. And you have to read the book to get to that. But I did live. I did live. But that's true. True story. Horrible story. And you know, just at the end of the story, you know, I come home with, I'm not killing the story, because the good part of the story at the very end of the story is Beth was saying, like, well, where were you? And I said, well, I was just held hostage at gunpoint. And she said, well, that took a long time. I said, I know the hostage thing takes a lot longer than you would expect. You know, it really doesn't move along like this. But it's a very good story. In fact, I think it's one of the stories that got me this second book. Yeah.
I have a 5-month-old at home, and I know you're a father of two, and I was wondering, can you give me some advice from your time of being a father to young children?
The best advice I ever got when I was working on Bird on a Wire is character actor, in fact, it was the night Anne's water broke, and Mel Gibson and I were shooting a night scene all night. And so Jeff Corey and I had dinner, and I was speculating about being a father, and he says, there are only three things you have to remember. Hold 'em, and hold 'em. And I think children learn about love from their parents. And I think it's important. It's difficult at times. And we read. That worked a lot. We read to our kids at night, and it wasn't long that they didn't want to read Berenstain Bears. They wanted me to read Charles Dickens to them. And I think reading is one of the greatest things you could do with kids. It's wonderful. And keep them away from video games as long as possible. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Nina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was character actor, author, and podcaster Stephen Tobolowsky, whose new book is My Adventures with God. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Kukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.